Welcome to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with Theodore Roosevelt scholar Clay Jenkinson about the 26th president. Jenkinson was a consultant for the new Ken Burns series, The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. Plus, we'll hear about the second season of the Sioux Falls-produced music television program, White Wall Sessions. But first, it's Friday, and time for our weekly discussion of the latest in state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining the program is Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. And Jonathan, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks, Carl.
Also with us is Denise Ross, web editor of the Mitchell Daily Republic. She's based in Rapid City. And Denise, good to have you with us today as well.
Hi, Carl. Good to be here.
Well, the South Dakota State Fair saw the second debates in the races for U.S. Senate and governor. In the Senate race, former Republican Governor Mike Rounds, Democrat Rick Wyland, Independent Larry Pressler, and Gordon Howey met in a debate sponsored by the South Dakota Farmers Union. And Jonathan Ellis, after two debates, does it look like much has changed in that U.S. Senate race?
No, I think the two debates were what you would have expected before they started. And, you know, you've had the three opponents of the presumptive front runner, Mike Rounds, and they've been aggressive going after him on various issues. That's what you would have expected. There haven't been any, Mike Rounds has played it safe, I think. He hasn't, gone after his opponents much. And again, that's what you would expect of somebody who believes that he's leading comfortably in the polls. So, you know, there have not been any sort of knockout blows or any, you know, major gaffes that any of the candidates have committed. Rick Wyland committed one sort of gaffe in the first debate when he referred to Mike Rounds as senator and then soon to be senator. But that was amusing. But there hasn't been any really real knockout blows or anything like that. And the debates, I think, have kind of gone off as how you would have expected them.
And Denise Ross, what are your thoughts after the first two Senate debates?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Mike Rounds, for the first time in his political career, really is having some really aggressive opposition. And so I think that's an interesting thing to watch how he contends with that. He's definitely, from what I have seen, and I didn't get to watch the state fair debates, I did read the coverage of that, but, it seems like he is a talking points candidate. He sticks to those talking points, and that no doubt they've been focus grouped to death. And he just keeps repeating that message over and over again. You'd expect a little more retail finesse in South Dakota to connect a little more with the voters and talk a little more personally. And maybe he's doing that one-on-one. You know, I haven't been privy to those conversations. But it's been an interesting race to watch. The polls are interesting. Rounds is still not above 50, and in some polls not above 40. So what that means for him varies. And of course, the only poll that really matters is on Election Day. So we'll see how this all goes.
Jonathan, what have we seen as far as polls from in-house? Not necessarily reliable polls, but have the campaigns issued any in-house polls?
Yeah, I mean, the Wyland campaign was sort of trumpeting a poll that was done by a Democratic polling firm from Washington. I think it only showed him down. Denise maybe knows the exact number, but maybe 5 to 7, something like that. Not down by much. And then on the other side, you've got the Republican, the Rounds campaign poll, which shows him up by a fairly comfortable lead given the number of candidates in the race. But I think, as Denise said, I don't know of a poll that has necessarily put him above 50%, but I'd point out at this point, the polling has been generally, pretty worthless right now. I mean, I especially given the time, given the time that it's been done. I mean, I think it would be, as you get more polls and closer to the election, I think then maybe you start to pay more attention to those. But right now, I don't know that they mean a whole lot.
Well, and polls in and of themselves are tricky because some of them are automated polls where people just have to push buttons. Some of them are actual live interviews with people. Sometimes people don't get the chance to choose an undecided option, and so they're forced to choose one or the other. And so all of those factors can really color the way those polls shake out. And the insiders like to get what's called the crosstabs, where you can really read all the questions, all the responses, and kind of do your own analysis. And so for the general public, I'd say take all the polls with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting thing to watch if you're following politics.
Are these polls measuring approval rating for the candidates, particularly Mike Rounds?
There have been some, yeah. There's a lot of polling going on, actually. It's interesting when my colleague David Montgomery and I were down in Vermilion last week, and on our way back up, he got a call, I think it was from the Republican National Committee that was doing a poll. So lots of different people are out polling right now.
Well, beyond the polls, the issues that have been discussed at the first two debates, what have they been? And are they giving us an idea of what will be discussed for the next couple of months before we get to Election Day in November, Denise?
Well, it looks like the candidates other than Rounds are really pushing this whole EB-5 question. I think that's an issue, and the Democrats are certainly pushing that as an organized party. You get a lot of emails and you see a lot of fundraising appeals based on that. But then you're also seeing questions raised about Rounds' record as governor, which I think there's some substance there to grab onto. How did he claims he balanced the budget. How did he do that? Well, he used federal stimulus money. That's pretty well known. And Gordon Howey, for one, just loves to point that out. Rick Wyland as well. And so as Mike Rounds is out there railing against big government, you have these other candidates saying, excuse me, but you relied on big government when you were governor to balance the state's budget. So those are two of the big ones that I see. Maybe Jonathan sees some other ones that are popping up.
Hey, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I Denise is correct that when Mike Rounds is sticking to his talking points, he's sticking to his talking points of attacking big government. I mean, that's who he's going after. And they're leaving the attacking of, you know, of the other candidates, not directly from Rounds, but they're going to leave that up to the Republican Party. So it is an issue, you know, as you know, the Rounds campaign pointed out that between him and Rick Wyland, they have different ideas of what government should be doing. Meanwhile, then you do have Howey criticizing Rounds for leaving this major deficit. But you had in the first debate, you had Rounds pointing out that Howey had voted for five of six budgets that actually authorized more spending than what Rounds had originally delivered in his budget address. So there's lots of things flying around back and forth.
You mentioned money. Have there been is much money coming to the state for television ads? Are we seeing many of them yet, Denise? That you're aware of, anyway?
Well, as some of your listeners are aware, I work from home with two used to be preschoolers. One just went off to kindergarten here this week, but so I've seen a few ads. I don't get to watch many. They don't run those on the Disney Channel typically, but I've seen Rick Wyland's ads. I've seen the Rounds, the ads that Mike Rounds ran during the primary. I haven't seen others. Now, I typically watch the evening news and, like I said, the kids programming, so I don't know if they're advertising on some of the other adult cable channels. I don't mean adult, but I mean more like grown-up fare, like the History Channel and those. That was, if you just think just a little history aside, when Mike Rounds was the total underdog in the 2002 governor's race, that's what he did with his TV ad. He cut his own video commercials, and then he posted them really cheap on those cable networks and really got some traction that way. So that is definitely a way you can effectively use TV advertising.
Jonathan, are you seeing many television ads yet?
Well, I got to be honest, I don't really watch TV, just because I don't have cable. But I do watch them when the campaigns put them out there. And Rick had his 15-second spots that he put out. But really, this, let's just for comparison's sake, and this will tell you a little bit about what this race is all about right now. Compare this to 2004. I mean, there were already plenty of TV ads flying within the summer, you know, which is typically the dead time of a campaign between the primary and sort of Labor Day. I mean, already there was major advertising going on, and you're just not seeing that in this race, and that tells you a little bit about the expectation, I think, that national groups have about what is happening here.
Well, moving on from the race for Senate, the governor's race, a couple of debates, the state fair debate and the Dakota Fest debate, incumbent Republican Dennis Dugard facing challengers Democrat Susan Wismer and independent Mike Myers. And EB-5 coming up during the Senate race, is that an issue at all in the governor's race, Denise?
Oh, yes, it is, and Susan Wismer has been pretty good at getting that to be an issue in her race. She's got a good platform as a member of the Government Operations and Audit Committee, which has been looking into this. She's pushed the issue that way, and then the Democratic Party has in tandem been very heavy on the emails and promoting the idea that there need to be subpoenas for Mike Rounds, Dennis Dugard, Yoak Bowl, and all the players that we're getting familiar with. And so there's a hearing coming up on the 24th of September, I believe is the date, for that committee, and I guess we'll see if people are subpoenaed, if they testify and they're not under oath. That's going to be a very interesting dynamic. I have never seen a legislative committee put anyone under oath, but boy, if there was ever a time when it might come into play, this is certainly one where you could see it maybe happening.
Jonathan Ellis, do you think that that September meeting later this month will have any sort of impact on the way either of these races would go?
I don't know. It certainly it's going to depend on who is there and who's talking. I mean, obviously, from a reporter standpoint, the more people there who are talking about what they know and what happened, that's a benefit. But with the EB-5 thing, you know, in the governor's race, you know, it came up in Dakota Fest in the Dakota Fest debate. You know, a couple times, especially from Mike Myers and then Susan Wismer. But, you know, in the most recent debate, it did not even really come up at all. Susan Wismer did not use it as an issue, which is surprising. You know, and there was one moment in the Dakota Fest debate where Dennis Dugard sort of had this line that, you know, at the end of the day, he said, you know, I wasn't there. You know, this was not my problem. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, he's, you know, trying to distance himself from the fact that, you know, this happened, and I think is without necessarily, you know, shoving it all onto Mike Rounds. So interesting line he's got to walk by basically saying, hey, all this stuff took place before I was governor. I'm trying to clean it all up without, again, making the Rounds campaign look bad.
The governor is traveling across the state, started yesterday, continuing today, sharing findings from the Workforce Summit report. The governor is saying that the state's economy is outpacing the population, creating a skill gap between job seekers and jobs available. This is something that he's talked about quite a bit over the past couple of years. Looking at this problem, is it something, Denise, that can be easily solved?
Well, I don't know if it were easily solved. It probably would have been already. You know, and we have the good luck or the bad luck of being situated right next to North Dakota, where the pay is going through the roof because of the oil boom. And I don't see that same effect happening down here. I haven't seen that boosting wages here yet. And so, you know, I think it's a pretty simple equation. If you're a worker, you know, you're going to go where you can make the most money, and if that's not in South Dakota, if that's not in a particular industry, you know, and I think we're seeing that with the teacher situation this year, where schools weren't able to fill all their teaching slots because of the low pay in South Dakota. So I think it's a pretty simple equation about boosting pay. I think you're going to do better attracting workers. But again, if it were that simple, then maybe we wouldn't be having these workforce summits all over. The governor talked about how important it is for the education system to be attuned to what's going on in business and industry and the job market and preparing students to enter that market. And I think that's a really insightful and good thing to do. It seems like an instinctive thing to do. And so just the implementation of how they're able to put that into place will be interesting to watch.
Jonathan Ellis, is there much that the governor can do about this?
Well, it's not a new problem. And maybe it's getting worse, but certainly not a new problem. I mean, it's an issue. I mean, this has been an issue. One of the things that sort of hinders economic growth in the state is there's not a workforce here necessarily. And you know, I mean, the governor came into office with a plan to offer. If you recall, they retained a temporary agency to try to bring in skilled workers in certain areas. And this was something he was dealing with from day one. And you know, I think everybody admitted that was a failure, but I mean, this is something that he's been trying to deal with since he came into office.
In moving to the U.S. House race, there's the race between Republican incumbent Kristi Noem and Democratic challenger Karina Robinson. There was a debate during Dakota Fest, but not at the state fair. This race, perhaps that's why it's not getting as much attention as the gubernatorial and Senate races. But I'm wondering, just looking at those other races, if this one would also be a little bit more interesting if there was a third party, Denise.
Well, I don't mean to be unkind, but it would even be more interesting if we had a Democratic candidate that was showing up and campaigning and raising money and doing all of that. I mean, one debate, if I'm not mistaken, at Dakota Fest, and she hasn't been on the campaign trail as far as I can tell. Maybe Jonathan knows a little more about that. But her fundraising is almost nothing, and so I don't know. I think if you had two candidates, it would be interesting, and if you had three, of course, it would be even more interesting.
Jonathan Ellis, what's your take on this race so far?
Well, it's not much of a race. It's one of those situations where, on paper, the Democratic candidate looked very good, but hasn't translated like that in the race. I mean, she was, at the Dakota Fest debate. She was totally overwhelmed by Kristi Noem, and it's an interesting debate from Kristi Noem. Any debate I'd ever seen her in before, she was quite willing to be in attack mode. In this particular debate, Kristi Noem barely acknowledged the existence of her opponent. I think thanked her in the beginning of the debate, and that was it. And that tells you that Kristi Noem does not at all feel threatened by this candidacy.
Looking at Kristi Noem as a candidate, now that she's winding up her second term, Denise Ross, does that have you seen that she has now the experience and confidence that maybe she didn't before?
Oh, I would say, I mean, I'm not sure what the basis for that question is, but I would say, yeah. I mean, when she first got elected, and they hold these conference calls almost every week with reporters where you get on for anywhere from 15 minutes to 45 minutes and ask questions, and those started out, I want to say, pretty choppy. And there came a point in time somewhere in the last year where you really kind of felt like she kind of got her sea legs, where she was able to answer the questions. She was much more comfortable doing that. I've seen her be much more comfortable with constituents than with the press. And so there should be a distinction made there. But, to watch her in the debate, to watch her handle the questions, I was at the hearing out here in Hot Springs a couple of weeks ago over the VA situation and her handling of that situation and the fellow members of Congress who were with her. It was all looked very, she's in the middle of an election campaign. I don't want to sound like I'm favoring somebody, but I think it's very fair to say that she has really grown into the role of Congress and gotten much more comfortable in that position.
Well, finally, I'd like to go back some 45 years in state politics because Jonathan Ellison, in your latest column in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, you wrote about what happened after U.S. Senator Carl Mundt suffered a massive stroke that happened the fall of 1969. He still had 3 years left in his term. Mundt stayed in office, and you write about why he didn't resign and what impact that had on South Dakota politics. Have you unraveled the mystery of why Carl Mundt didn't resign?
I think to some extent, but I think there's still some unanswered questions, and I think unfortunately some of those went to the graves with some, a lot of the players here are no longer with us, and so but it's an interesting era, and it led to the Democrats to a large degree being able to take control for a brief period, and actually there were some reforms that were started under Frank Farrar. But Dick Knipe and Democrats in the legislature were really able to sort of change state government. I mean, our modern state government exists because of what Democrats were able to do in the 70s, and they got rid of certain obsolete offices and some of the patronage positions that existed and remade state government. So it's certainly a turning point in South Dakota politics.
So the state is still feeling the consequences from a month staying in office?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yep.
And that in 1972, I think you had a quote from Senator, or who was James Abaresque, who was elected senator in 1972, that he didn't think that he would have been elected if Carl Mundt had stayed in office.
Yeah, it's his feeling that if you know, the Republicans had been successful in naming somebody in 1970, somebody who would have been basically had a couple years to establish themselves in the office, he would not have been able to have been successful. Now, I mean, that's probably, you know, that when somebody has a couple of years to establish themselves and get voters get used to them, that's generally true. Although in Montana we saw a situation where the Democratic appointee there, that was what the Democrats were trying to do there, and get somebody appointed and give them a chance to win re-election, but we saw that that person had a major problem. So it doesn't always work out that way.
All right. Well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies this week. Jonathan, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks, Carl.
And Denise, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you.
Denise Ross is web editor of the Mitchell Daily Republic. She's based in Rapid City. Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, and you can find his column about Carl Mundt on the Argus Leader website. The Dakota Political Junkies are a regular Wednesday feature of Dakota Midday.